From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, plant managers move toward restarting some of the biggest manufacturing operations in the state.
The automakers, I think, are going to be starting slowly with single shifts. They are bringing a whole set of health and safety protocols into the plant to protect the workforce.
We'll talk through what has to happen first. Also, a protest on reopening the economy gives way to a discussion of guns at the state capitol.
What happened last week had a very aggressive tone to it, and the staff and I think people in the building just felt differently about it. It really exceeded anything that had been seen in the past.
And one mother and daughter talk about the bittersweetness of a physically distanced graduation.
Of course, graduation day is something that every student looks forward to. And Brianna was the firstborn grandchild on both sides of our family. We had relatives who purchased tickets to fly in and attend.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. A conversation has begun about firearms at Michigan's state capitol. Later this hour, we consider who should make the decision on restrictions for open carry. But first, the clock is ticking. In less than 2 weeks, Detroit's automakers, their suppliers, and the United Auto Workers are hoping to begin the complex process of restarting manufacturing operations. This is not just a matter of flipping a switch and watching the line roll. Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News. He's been writing about preparations for a restart, and he joins us now. Daniel, hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. Hey, I guess my first question is, what is going on with supply chain to make this possible? Automakers are so dependent on factories, either in other states or China and Mexico. I mean, can the automakers get the parts they need right now?
Well, I think they can, but you're right. This is a very complex undertaking that is not really well understood, I suppose, by a lot of people who are not in the industry. First off, you've got suppliers that need to be operating at least 5 days before the automakers begin to come up and restart production. They're looking at Monday, May 18th, which would mean that by next Monday, some suppliers need to be operating to be able to fill the supply chain. That's number one. Number two, you have a lot of different stay-at-home and various other kinds of orders in different states that could be housing different suppliers, as well as three countries in the North American bloc, Mexico, the United States, and Canada. So they have to get all of that harmonized to be able to come back to work. I think the expectation is, as you said at the open, you know, you're not just flipping a switch. The automakers, I think, are going to be starting slowly with single shifts. They are bringing a whole set of health and safety protocols into the plant to protect the workforce, much of which was developed in China and South Korea, also to some extent in Europe. And now they are implementing that here in the United States.
You wrote this week that if the industry restarts and things don't go well, that it could be as damaging as not restarting soon enough. Could you unpack what you meant by that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that this is all very, very expensive. To sit idle burns, in the case of Ford, $3 billion. General Motors' burn wasn't as much. Chrysler's wasn't as much. But nevertheless, you burn through an enormous amount of money. Stopping and starting also is very expensive. You want to get moving because that's revenue that goes out the door. And once the way this system works, once the vehicles leave the plant, they typically are purchased by dealers, wholesalers, and so you want to get stuff out of the plant because you want to be able to get to start to reinflate the revenue line, which has been totally deflated over this last 6-7 weeks. You know, we just got numbers this week on earnings for the first quarter. Now,
right,
the lines had only been shut down for about 2 weeks, roughly, at the end of the quarter. So you see, as someone like Ford, who loses $2 billion, GM was able to eke out a $294 million profit. FCA lost about, I think, $1.8 billion. Now we're looking at a 7 week or so at the inside shutdown in the second quarter. So I think that the numbers for the second quarter for the companies are going to be magnitudes worse than they were in the first quarter. But the question is how quickly they can get restarted. They clearly are going to have a bias towards high demand, high margin, high revenue vehicles, which in this industry, in this town, means pickup trucks and SUVs.
Right, the larger models. What do we know about how sales are going?
I think surprisingly well, actually, all things considered. That's one of the reasons GM did as well as it did in the quarter, is because they were selling a lot of their high revenue, high profit trucks and SUVs before they had to stop production. But even in April, they were selling some of those same vehicles in markets where they were allowed to sell.
So we've been talking over the past few months about how the future of the industry is electric, and that many, many automakers are very serious about meeting some goals for more electrified vehicles and more hybrids in the years to come. What do you think this all means for those plans?
Well, I think you have to bifurcate this a little bit. We're working on a piece on this actually this week at the Detroit News, and the bucket has several pieces to it. There's electrification, as you point out. There's also self-driving vehicles, also known as autonomous vehicles, and mobility services like an Uber, like a Lyft, like a Maven that General Motors had, which was essentially a rental car. You get an hourly or daily rental car service. Mobility is having to be totally rethought because people are rethinking whether they want to get in someone else's car, maybe with somebody else in it that they don't know, to go from point A to point B in Washington, D.C. And as a result, people, I think, are pulling back. Automakers are canceling a lot of those programs. So you put that aside. Self-driving, the technology is not there right now, and that tends to be linked to other kinds of technologies. So they're focusing that more on the delivery of goods than on the delivery of people, which leaves you with electrification. This week, the CEO of General Motors, as well as others, said, "We are totally committed to our electrification plans. We are going to go ahead with them." I think it's 20 different vehicles that they're planning over the next three or so years. And so I think people are hanging on to electrification, thinking that is going to be a legitimate powertrain option that will be available to consumers, not only in the United States, but in Europe and in China. Probably the regulatory change that's driving that in those markets is not likely to change very much. Although I do think coming out of this slowdown, both in Europe and North America, there is going to be a bias politically and from a regulatory perspective for jobs. So to the extent that these new technologies were to negatively impact the job creation in the marketplace, I think that there's going to be pressure for the companies to continue to build ICEs, internal combustion engines, and the typical vehicles that we're used to.
That's such an interesting question right now. What does the world need more of? More vehicles, more innovative vehicles, or more jobs-making vehicles?
Well, it is. And also when you recognize that a lot of the electricity that is powering those vehicles is being generated with burning of fossil fuels.
Right. Daniel, it's been pointed out more than once that this pandemic has exposed certain fault lines in the global economy. When your business relies on other countries with different costs of doing business, different standards for the environment and healthcare, it can be a benefit. But when those systems are challenged, you might get stuck. Do you foresee any long-term reevaluation of how supply chain works because of what's happening right now?
I think the short answer is yes. But I also think that if we go back a few months when the pandemic was really focused on China, I remember having conversations with people at the companies about this and their concerns about sourcing. And you may remember that they really didn't have problems getting sourcing into their various plants in Asia. And one of the reasons was that they have a lot of redundancies built into their system. So if you're sourcing certain components from China, you may also be sourcing from plants in, say, Vietnam or Thailand. So you're in the region and you still have ways to be able to source componentry to be able to continue to produce vehicles because you have redundant systems. You know, one of the things that I've learned over the years is that if you look at the major vehicle producing parts of the world, principally Asia, Europe, and North America, every single one of those places has got one place that is a low-cost producer for componentry. In Asia, it's China. In Europe, it's Eastern Europe. And in North America, of course, it's Mexico. And that's partly how the ecosystem works, is you have a regional lower-cost producer, not necessarily the lowest, but lower-cost producer that enables you to manage cost. And they're doing that around the world. So, but I do think, to your point, I think everybody is rethinking and will be rethinking where they're sourcing things from. When you're getting all sorts of personal protective equipment coming from China, and all of a sudden you need it and you can't get it, that's a problem. And you have people like Detroit car companies that are coming in and repurposing plants that are barely being used, or in the case of Warren Transmission, had just been closed, totally closed,
right,
reopening and retooling them to make face masks, face shields, gowns, masks, and ventilators, which they're doing, GM's doing in Kokomo, and Ford's doing in Rossinville now, come to think of it. So you got a lot of this stuff going on, but I think the fact that the market reacted, I think that partly answers your question, is that yes, people, not only are they going to rethink it, they already have.
I have one more operational question as May 18th gets a little bit closer. What is the size and the scale of the automakers' plans for sanitation and health monitoring within their factories? I mean, are we thinking thermometers at every entrance when people report in for work?
Yes. Some of your listeners could probably find it on their websites. Ford and General Motors particularly, and I think FCA as well, have put together what they're calling a playbook, which is their whole protocol about how they're going to approach safety in the plants, what people are going to have to do, how they're going to, I think, even have to dress. I know that in the case of, I think it was at Kokomo GM, you know, you had to be there with long pants and long shirts, no shorts, no short sleeve shirts. I mean, there were protocols for how you had to show up and go to work. And that included limited access. I don't expect you're going to get visitors into these plants and people going in. And I don't think media people are going to be able to go in and take pictures and everything else. I mean, you're going to be very controlled about who can be in there and do they pass a protocol every day. Gloves, masks, shields, the whole nine yards. They're, you know, let's just be honest. It does not benefit the union. It doesn't benefit the company to get lax on this and to have to shut down operations if they have an infection. It clearly does not benefit anybody involved in the process. So to the extent that they can mitigate it, they will. And they've done a lot of this and developed this in China and in South Korea, and were able to run in South Korea pretty effectively in the case of General Motors. Ford developed some of this coming out of their European plants and also some of their operations in China, and have been somewhat successful. And I think they feel like they know how to manage it. But we're going to find out here in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Indeed. Daniel, thanks very much.
You bet.
Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Parents and kids of all ages have their work cut out for them during the pandemic. A couple of weeks ago, we brought you a conversation with an elementary grade teacher in Detroit Public Schools Community District who was doing what she could for the kids that she knows, both in terms of instruction and a nightly story hour. Since then, we realized she was also showing up for another young person in her life, so it seemed like a good time to check in. Von Seal Campbell is a master math teacher at Warren E. Bow Elementary. Ms. Campbell, welcome back to Stateside.
Thank you. Nice. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's handle some business first. As we mentioned, you've been doing story time for kids every night. And the last time we talked, you were having a little trouble sourcing the books. And we got a flood of messages from people who wanted to know how that turned out. Have you been able to get what you need?
Yes, I spoke with someone from the Detroit Public Library, and they have me now where I can check books out electronically, and they come right to my Kindle. And that's been working out wonderfully because I check out multiple books at a time. I'm able to ship through the catalogs easily. So it works out well for any book that I'm looking for. I can search by topic. So it's going very well now.
For anybody who's listening, Von Seal's story hours are available via her Twitter account, and we will tag it on our Stateside feed as well. So since we talked, we also heard a little bit more offline about your daughter, who is one of the latest graduates of Michigan State University. And I believe Brianna McClendon is with us today, right?
Yes, I am. Hello.
Hey, Brianna. Well, how did you two spend the weekend?
Well, this weekend, I was supposed to graduate on May 3rd, Sunday, but unfortunately, due to the pandemic, I wasn't able to walk across the stage at State. So my mom surprised me with a brunch with my family. She decorated our entire dining room with Congrats 2020 grad decorations. A few people drove by and gave me roses, and it was just a great day.
Oh, man. I suppose it's the understatement of the century to say this isn't really what you were expecting for this spring, right?
Definitely not. I was expecting to do so much with my friends. My friends all had plans, and my friend was even trying to do something and send me something in the mail because they were all so disappointed they weren't able to celebrate me and my other friend, Charlena, who also graduated. But, you know, we're making the best out of what we can.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, what kind of feelings does that bring up at a time when people are usually pretty keyed about starting the next phase of their life anyway, to sort of have look around and see the rest of the world is almost frozen?
It's really disappointing. I was really looking forward to graduating, especially since college has been, you know, full of highs and lows and ups and downs. So I was looking forward to something. I was really excited, but it's just been like a really disappointing experience, to be honest.
Yeah. Brianna, I understand you majored in English with a concentration in creative writing. It certainly feels like this is all going to be fodder for one hell of a story someday. Has it altered any of your immediate plans to try to find some work?
Definitely. A lot of the jobs that I've been applying for are having hiring freezes, so I've been honestly at a standstill right now, which has been really difficult. A lot of seniors have been trying to apply for jobs, and no job is able to do anything because, you know, no one is sure of if it'll be extended, how long this is going to last, so everyone's kind of been at a standstill.
Sure. Von Seel, this can be a big moment in a parent's life as well. What was on your mind when you realized what this was going to mean for her?
I, too, was very disappointed because, of course, graduation day is something that every student looks forward to, whether it be coming out of high school or college. And Brianna was the firstborn grandchild on both sides of our family. And so everybody was really, really excited. We had relatives who purchased tickets to fly in and attend and everything. So I was super disappointed. And all I could think of is, what can I do to still make her day special, you know, so she could have some things to remember, regardless of whether they're, you know, that different from her potential, what her potential situation would have been like. So I just wanted to do something for her to make her feel special, although we do look forward to the graduation being taking place at a later date. But right now, I just really wanted to do something for her because it hurt me. You know, I knew she was looking forward to it, and I just had to do something to kind of turn it around, at least for the moment.
For sure. You know, there was a time when people in your position, Brianna, would think nothing of applying for jobs out of state, especially if they were thinking of getting into writing, maybe finding some magazine work. I know that you said that was something that appealed to you. Does leaving the state for something elsewhere sound like, does that sound any more frightening right now?
Absolutely not. I'm really adventurous and I'm always ready to do something new. I was born and raised in Michigan, so I'm actually looking for jobs out of state. My goal states are Atlanta and New York, but, you know, those are really competitive states, so I've just been doing my best to trying to find a job out there.
Okay, Von Seel, how does that sit with you? What's it like to think about her maybe leaving in the middle of this?
In the middle of this, I am totally in disagreement. We have had this conversation. You know, it's already surprising with me having two kids that are in, well, she's graduated from college this semester, but I also have my son who's a sophomore at Juilliard. And all of a sudden, they're back home. They were both removed, you know, in the third quarter of their semester. So it was a really big deal. So as a parent, regardless of whether they're 20 and 23, I still want to protect them. I want to make sure they're safe. I want to make sure they have everything they need. So I prefer to have them here with me until this is all over, just so I can keep my arms wrapped around them as a parent. I mean, I know they're grown, but I'm still mom.
Absolutely. You know, I heard this interview a couple of weeks ago with an astronaut who had done training for a long-term space mission. And she talked about the things that you have to do when you're in confinement with others for a long time. What would you say is working for your family when, you know, everyone has things that they would like to be doing right now, but those things just aren't always possible?
Yes. You know, this experience has provided us with more bonding time, I'd say, because like I said, both of them being away on their separate campuses, we didn't really have a lot of chances to sit down and watch movies. So Brianna and I are watching a lot of girly movies. You know, we've discussed some books and we've tried recipes. We're cooking together. And my son is a cellist, so he plays his cello from morning to noon till night. So that has not changed for him. But just being here, you know, and reflecting on the family times back when they were small. And we're just kind of bringing some of those things back to life. I actually bought a Frisbee and a ball toss game and everything. So we're making the most out of what we have. And also we're thankful that we have several rooms in our house so that when we're tired of looking at one another, everybody can go have their own space.
That is key. If you have any film recommendations for us, I think everybody is looking for something a little different in the queue. So,
yeah, we watch such a variety of everything. I'm a very adventurous movie type person. So Avengers and Captain America and everything that's Marvel, I love those kind of things. And then we have our love stories. You know, we watch some old movies. I actually introduced Brianna to a couple of movies from back in the 80s. And she was really surprised by it. It was like School Days and
Players Club,
which was awful. She was really too young to be watching that until this point. But classic. So I introduced her to some old movies, but she's been enjoying them. So just spending these moments, you know, catching up and, you know, reflecting back on some things and sharing with them is like, it's a great experience. They're not tired of mom yet, especially my cooking.
That's something I think every person sort of coming out of school is a little nostalgic about when they go off on their way. If you're just joining us, our guests are Von Seal Campbell, who's a math teacher at Warren E. Bau School in Detroit, and her daughter, Brianna McClendon. Von Seal, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your day job. The teachers at Bau School, I know, have had a couple of weeks now of distance learning. And as we mentioned, you're a math teacher. What's it been like?
Well, you know, we have daily sessions where we're set up on a schedule where the students are to log in with the teachers and we hold classes. You know, the biggest issue is still the students lacking technology that's necessary and, you know, having the low numbers. I have 32 students in my class, and the most students I've had in one lesson thus far is 5. So typically it's somewhere between 2 and 4 or 5 students a day. You know, I really wish I could do more, but I am absolutely making the most out of every opportunity that I can. And we're constantly reaching out. Our support team at Bau is actually reaching out on a regular basis, just trying to bring these students together, trying to get the packets to them that the schools have, that the district actually created for them, that takes us through the online learning system as far as every subject is concerned. But the most difficult part is just not being able to reach them all. You know, it's not easy. Yeah, it really brings me down a bit.
It occurs to me that this is probably pretty complicated because you're working with young people. If it was a normal workplace, you might just reach out to them another way. But I imagine that it's not really a best practice to connect with students on Instagram or Facebook.
Yeah, I agree. You know, I did. The one reason why I put my stories on Facebook is because so many of our children do have social media accounts, whether they're legal or illegal, according to their age.
Right.
But, so we use, you know, I'm still reaching out through Class Dojo. I have a Google Voice number that I send group text through to parents. And we just call them on their regular cell phones or home phones and send personal text messages too. But it's just difficult. And then during this time, one thing I've learned from trying to contact some parents, some of the parents who had like government issued phones and things, or either they had contracted phones and are no longer able to pay their bills because they've lost their jobs, we now have no way of accessing them via telephone because they either have a new number or no working number at all.
Oh, man. And it's not possible for the school to reach them in another way to get back in contact. That's tough.
At this point, not really, because we do have our attendance officer who makes home visits. But based on the quarantine, he's not able to make those home visits. So we just have to wait.
Von Seal, I heard that in the middle of everything else that's going on, you received a major award.
Yes, I did. I have been awarded Teacher of the Year for Bau Elementary School for the 2019-2020 school year.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
I don't know if medals and trophies mean much right now, but that's got to feel pretty good.
Yes, it's amazing. This is my first year at Bau, and we actually voted. And I was nominated, and we held the voting just in the first week of March or so, right before school let out. And because I had heard nothing else about it, and since, you know, the quarantine started, I had no idea they were still actually going to hold, you know, these positions for the year. But I got an email and I was like, oh my goodness. So yeah, it's amazing. It's a big one.
We know you've got some stiff competition throughout the rest of the district and the region, but I'll be curious to see how this year's balloting plays out after this.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Because now it puts you into like the pool for them to pick a teacher of the year for the entire district. And they usually pick like up to like four people, and then they choose the top one out of those four finalists. So yeah, last year I didn't make a finalist position, but you know, I don't know. It's a new year. We'll see.
A new year. And it really just feels like the goalposts for Teacher of the Year have probably changed so much in just a matter of weeks.
Yeah, I'm sure it has. But again, I was really surprised, like I said, because we voted that first year week of March and we were still in school when the voting took place. But since I had heard nothing, I'm sure that this was not on the top of the priority list for everything they had to do to pull the district together. So yeah, I was surprised to get the email.
Well, congratulations. That is just beyond awesome.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Ladies, I just want to thank you so much for everything that you're putting into the world and for taking some time with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Von Seal Campbell is a master math teacher at Bow School in Detroit, and Brianna McClendon is her daughter and a recent graduate of Michigan State. Twenty-seven residents in northwest Lower Michigan have died because of the COVID-19 outbreak. In tight-knit communities to the north, each passing has come as a blow. Those closest to the deceased remember how they live. Interlochen Public Radio's Taylor Wisner shares their stories.
Lisa Watson heard her brother had a bad chest cold. It wasn't going away after a week or two.
From my understanding is he'd just been sick with what they thought was bronchitis.
On a Tuesday, Mike Watson drove to the hospital to get another chest x-ray. But in the parking lot, Mike suddenly collapsed and died on the spot. He was 51 years old when he passed away on February 25th, 2 weeks before Governor Whitmer first announced positive cases of coronavirus in Michigan. Mike was a firefighter and EMT for over 20 years in Otsego County. It was his colleagues who immediately responded to the scene of their fallen friend. They didn't know it then, but soon they too would have to fight the virus. An early outbreak in Otsego County led several EMS workers to fall ill. Two ended up on ventilators. At Mike's funeral, which was weeks before the stay-at-home order, his colleagues called on the EMT scanner to say a final goodbye.
Hearing no response from Unit 5505, Lieutenant Mike Watson has responded to his last call on Earth. Thank you for always answering the call. Thank you for unselfishly always lending a helping hand.
Mike was a big guy, 6'2", but like a teddy bear. Lisa says he was known as a helper, and family, especially his daughter, was everything to him.
He taught her so many things that a lot of daughters don't learn. But like she can back up a boat in a trailer. She knows how to repair the brakes on her car.
Mike used his handiness to help his elderly parents who live nearby. It brought comfort to the whole family.
Just that he's not going to be there to help with the things that they need. He helped.
A few weeks later, more cases of COVID-19 began appearing in northern Michigan. Harbor Springs residents Shannon and Larry Cummings stayed put at home even before the governor ordered it. But they had already caught a fever. They both came down with it one night, but Larry was having a worse reaction.
It started out okay, and then it went downhill from there.
When Shannon drove him to the hospital, she didn't realize it was the last time she'd hear her husband speak. Grief hits as she remembers their plans. They were supposed to go on a trip to the Balkans in Southeast Europe. He was looking forward to reading a new book.
Just bought on a new Paul Theroux book. I don't even know if he read it yet. I don't think he had. Aw.
Larry had been a professor at North Central Michigan College in Petoskey for 50 years. He was known for his sense of humor, showing slides of his travels all over the world, and for being open to many different views. He took his students on trips to Mexico, which was sometimes the students' first visit outside the country.
I think he enjoyed helping people to see other parts of the world and see bigger than themselves.
Shannon says over the years, Larry's gotten many letters from his former students who went on to become teachers. They all cite Larry's influence as a big reason why. Later, in nearby Boyne City, the community was rocked by local business leader Ed Brehm's sudden passing. Ed and his wife, Christine, hadn't yet moved to Boyne City when Scott McKenzie met him many years ago.
I kind of credited myself for one of the reasons they moved to Boyne, because I sold them on this community. And both he and Christine became actively involved in our community, became staples in this town.
Scott was the director of the Chamber of Commerce at the time. He watched Ed build a successful business. The family bought the local party store 10 years ago and expanded it to a wine emporium and tasting room. He loved wine and became a certified sommelier. Scott says the family is one of the most giving in the town. He says Ed loved Boyne City and always saw potential.
There was always some brand new great adventure, and he was game to take it on.
Since Boyne Country Provisions posted notice of Ed's passing, people have put up signs on the shop's windows mourning his loss. Scott says they'll remember the fun theme parties he'd throw and think of him while they drink the unique wine he recommended. These are just three important members of our Northern Michigan community. There are others taken by COVID-19, too. I'm Taylor Wisner.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Michigan's state capitol building is viewed broadly as the people's house. Unlike most government buildings, there are no restrictions on movement, only to the House and Senate chambers. And there also are no restrictions on open carrying firearms at the Capitol. On May 1st, dozens of protesters entered the building in Lansing, screaming sometimes at security and police, and carrying high-powered rifles into the state Senate gallery, where some continued to make their views known to the assembled lawmakers at full volume. Those sights shook up a lot of people. The Michigan State Capitol Commission has discussed whether some action might be appropriate. Some legislators have also been talking about whether certain rules on guns at the state capitol might be something that lawmakers should talk about. John Truscott is vice chair of the Michigan State Capitol Commission. He's also a principal at Truscott Rossman Public Relations in Lansing. Mr. Truscott, welcome back to Stateside.
Glad to be here.
Now, this is not a terribly unusual sight. Every year in Lansing, there's a Second Amendment Day at the Capitol, and gun enthusiasts show up and walk around in the House and Senate galleries. Was something about last week's protests different in your view?
Clearly, it was different. I think there's a different level of frustration and anger. And when Capitol Commission staff has interacted with the Second Amendment rally folks, they've always been respectful. They've been calm and collected. They've been really good to work with. And there have been no concerns, no issues at all. What happened last week had a very aggressive tone to it. It was a different nature. And the staff and I think people in the building just felt differently about it, and that it really exceeded anything that had been seen in the past.
When protesters with guns do show up at the Capitol, it reminded some of us that there are no posters or signs allowed at the Capitol building, meaning to say you can carry in a rifle or a handgun, but you can't carry a sign that makes your political views known. How did Michigan's rules get set in this way?
You know, there were rallies, and I can't remember the exact timing of this, but there were rallies roughly 20 years ago or so that signs were brought into the building and actually did some damage. There have been other protests where people were pounding on the railings around the building, sometimes just with their hands, and then their rings did damage, but other times that they were pounding with things that made additional noise, and it did damage the paint on the railings. So we have had damage in the Capitol, and this is historic, very expensive paint to keep. There's texture to it and relief effects to it. So, you know, we try to keep the building in as pristine condition as possible. It is a living, breathing, working museum. And so I think at the time the legislature, because there were quite a few signs and other things brought in the building, just said we're not going to take the chance of having that kind of damage. So anything brought in like a sign would have to stay outside.
There are places in Michigan that have been designated as gun-free zones, schools, campuses of higher education. What's the difficulty in talking about making the Capitol gun-free?
You know, there's a legal aspect and then a practical aspect at the same time. On the practical side, we have always tried to keep the building as open and accessible to the public as possible. In addition to being, as I said, a living museum, it is a place where the people's business does get done. So open access is really important to us. And in addition, we have a lot of kids who come through for tours. It's a beautiful building and it's a wonderful tour to take if anybody hasn't done so. We have also discovered, and we expect to get a legal briefing on at our regularly scheduled meeting on Monday, that the Capitol Commission does not have jurisdiction on things like guns in the Capitol. We would not, I don't think, have jurisdiction on signs either. Any restrictions have to take place in the legislature and be done by state law.
And yet, do you feel that the commission has some responsibility to talk about what happened?
Yeah, I think we will talk about it. We are going to get a briefing. We've asked our legal counsel for a history and how we got to where we are today, and then for what our jurisdiction is. I have been telling people, I said, we're kind of like the caretakers of a museum. That's our responsibility, the physical part of the building, the infrastructure of the building, so the heating and cooling and electrical and the staff that maintains the building, as well as the grounds around the building. We have not had to get involved in anything like whether guns should be permitted or not in the building. It's just been beyond our purview.
Yeah. I know that there have been some conversations among members of the legislature about how some sort of action might be taken. The bills that have been proposed so far seem mostly to have come from Democrats, so it's not clear what the path forward would be with the legislature under Republican control. But have you talked to any lawmakers about this, about how they felt about the protests or their consideration of changing the rules?
I've talked to a few lawmakers. I've talked to some lobbyists and staff as well. The lawmakers that I've talked to have been on the Democrat side. I have not talked to Republicans, but you know, pretty much across the board, there was the same concern that this group that was in the building, half a dozen or so individuals that I'm told by unofficial sources, some of them may not even be Michigan residents, but that there was a different feel to these individuals, much more threatening than what has ever happened before. And that's a big concern for a lot of people.
A number of observers came away feeling that no one deserves to do their job with someone brandishing a gun standing right next to them. And there was a sense, even from Senate Majority Leader Mike Shirky, that the protesters were trying to intimidate. If nothing changes, I mean, you have some political experience having worked in the Engler administration. If nothing changes in Lansing, do you think those intimidation tactics will have been successful?
I think those tactics backfired. That's a legitimate message and concern about frustration for the economy and not being able to work and people just expressing their views, which is their First Amendment right to do so. But these six individuals really hijacked that entire message and diverted it to one of safety in our Capitol building and concern for the people that work there. And look, I'm a Second Amendment advocate. I'm a gun owner. But there is absolutely no reason to bring a loaded rifle into the Capitol building. That's just over the top. And I've talked to a lot of fellow gun owners who feel exactly the same way.
John Truscott is vice chair of the Michigan State Capitol Commission. John, thank you very much for your time.
You're very welcome.
The conversation around guns, safety, and Michiganders' rights prompted one Lansing journalist, Jonathan Osting, to put this question to Twitter. Were there ever metal detectors at Michigan's Capitol? Only a couple of people remembered. Yes, there was a time when metal detectors were used to screen protesters visiting the legislature, but the issue at hand wasn't gun rights or even COVID. This was in 1999, during a controversial debate about a state takeover of Detroit's public schools. And one of those journalists who remembered the day was Ken Coleman. Back then, he was working as a legislative assistant, and he's with us now. Ken Coleman, welcome back to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
We've spent a lot of time talking as a state about emergency management laws for school districts and cities over the past decade, but it's hard to remember. Much of that debate begins in 1999. Can you remind us what was happening with this question 21 years ago?
Yeah, absolutely. As you pointed out, I was a legislative assistant for a Michigan House member. And for those that don't remember, really the emergency manager law was signed into being a decade before, 1989 or 1990. But it took front stage at the beginning of the year in 1999 when there was legislation entered, certainly supported by then Governor John Engler, to take over the Detroit Public Schools. And at that time, it was a very controversial effort, to be sure, an effort that caused dozens and probably hundreds of Detroit residents to travel 90 miles, an hour and a half to Lansing to protest the state action that was happening at that time.
So the protesters consisted of administrators and parents and some teachers, most all from Detroit, yes?
Absolutely. Certainly Detroit Public School administrators, many parents, but also civil rights activists and really sort of a myriad of organizations and individuals who were very much concerned about the state's effort to usurp home rule, if you will, and take over a school district that had duly elected men and women serving as its board of education.
Do you remember at the time who made the call that metal detectors should be in use as people were entering the Capitol building to take part in the debate?
I was working for a Democratic member of the state house. And at that time, the Republicans controlled both chambers, both the House and the Senate. And so I don't recall who actually signed off on the actual use of metal detectors, but certainly Chuck Perricone, who's a Republican from Kalamazoo, who was the House Speaker, and Dan DeGroe from Port Huron, who was the Senate Majority Leader, had to have signed off on it, both Republicans.
Now, I know that you were working as a legislative assistant and weren't on Capitol security or working for the sergeant at arms, but do you remember if there was anything essentially violent or questionable about the protests in the gallery?
You know, one of the things about being a legislative assistant, and as you know very well, House and Senate floor rights are you know, only House and Senate members can operate and walk around on the floor unless you are a former member. I think those men and women would have rights. But the role of a legislative assistant like myself was to receive constituents and people who were visiting the Capitol. So I spent a lot of time in the galleries of both chambers. And I don't recall any violence per se, but certainly men and women who were members of the Michigan State Police definitely made sure with a wand, at that time it wasn't a freestanding metal detector, but a wand, checked every man and woman who entered the gallery in both chambers. And no violence I can remember, but certainly, you know, I talked to a lot of people who had traveled from Detroit who really felt like the prospect, and at the first, and understanding was the first time it had ever been done, the prospect of having to go through a metal wand, a Michigan State trooper.
Submit to that kind of search, yeah.
Yeah, it was, you know, it harkens some back to Jim Crow era policies in the South that in that case, African-Americans were subjected to and others weren't just because they were African-American.
Yeah. And as far as we could tell, is it your memory as well that at no time since then metal detectors have been used at the state's capital? Even though there have been plenty of contentious
yeah,
measures passed.
Absolutely. Lots of contentious issues, right? The work, expansion of the emergency manager law in the 2000s. But I cannot think of another time either prior to or after 1999 where metal detectors were used in the Michigan State Capitol.
Ken, I have to ask, when you saw some of the photos and videos that were being posted from the protests at the state capitol on May 1st, were you thinking back to those days when the legislature was talking about the school's takeover and how, you know, a different group of African-American protesters were met?
Absolutely. I thought about those days in 1999. Also thought about a former state lawmaker who ultimately became the mayor of the city of Detroit, a gentleman named Kwame Kilpatrick, who in 2001 described Michigan as the Mississippi of the North because of actions being carried out in the Lansing protests over the last couple of weeks, and because of decisions by elected officials to institute metal detectors for people who happen to live in Detroit. It really caused me to think that while Michigan has been progressive in a lot of different ways politically, it still has a lot of challenges when it comes to race, to class, and to gender.
You know, the law enforcement view of the May 1st protest is that, all things considered, given the composition and who showed up and how many people were openly carrying, that it could have been a lot worse. One of the protesters was arrested for being accused of getting into a physical fight with somebody else who was present that day. And there is an investigation into some of the behavior that we saw in the House gallery. But again, the perception from those who were in charge of keeping order that day was that the situation really wasn't that bad. Ken, I wanted to ask you, just as someone who, you know, who reports on issues like this and is physically present, do you think something should be done about guns at the Capitol?
I think so. You know, listen, I'm a working reporter that covers state government. I'm not a columnist or an opinion writer. So oftentimes I like to reserve my personal opinions and keep them to myself because I do help to cover state government. But look, as an African-American, as a 52-year-old African-American who lives in the city of Detroit, and to see some of the video images and the photos that I've seen in terms of Lansing protests over the last couple of weeks, I'm almost beyond words to describe my disappointment in law enforcement to not enforce what I understand it, state edicts toward social distancing. And that's on one end of it. And the other end of it is what I've just seen as just straight up hate speech. Again, with regard to race, class, gender, I'm appalled by what I've seen over the last couple weeks in Lansing protests. And you know, I'm a Michigan resident who feels like I think law enforcement has dropped the ball.
Ken Coleman works for Michigan Advance. You can read his writing there. And he is also the author of several titles on Michigan history. Ken, thank you for talking with us today.
Thank you.
We're always glad to hear your takes, whether it's the post-COVID economy, protests, what's happening to kids or seniors during the pandemic, or anything else that's on your mind. Send us an email. The address is stateside@michiganradio.org. You can leave comments on the Michigan Radio Facebook page or hit us on Twitter. Our handle is Stateside Radio. Tomorrow on the show, we check in with Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Dingell, who represents Michigan's 12th district. We're asking her about her push for more help for Michigan's auto industry in the next stimulus package and the biggest concerns for her constituents right now.
People are still worried about their unemployment checks, although the number of calls is beginning to diminish. But if you're one of the people that hasn't gotten them, it's scary, it hurts, you're scared, and you want to get through the system.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you on Friday.